Dr. Zeitman commented on the emerging role of cytotoxic chemotherapy in clinical trials in prostate cancer, and I met with Dr. Nancy Dawson for her take on where this is headed. To begin, I asked her to present a patient from her practice who typified the path being taken in this field of investigation.
I have a 48-year-old gentleman who actually lied about his age because he wanted to be screened for prostate cancer. And there was free screening at his institution, but they said they were only screening people who were over 45. And he was 44.
Why did he have this feeling about getting screened so strongly?
Well, you know, he had three young children, and his wife had chronic myelogenous leukemia and had received a bone marrow transplant. She was doing well, but he just was concerned. He had a family history of prostate cancer.
In whom?
A father, you know, who didn't die of prostate cancer, but he just had, you know, a concern that he wanted to stay healthy. He knew that there was, in his mind, a screening test. And so he got a PSA test done. And he was, at the time, I guess, 44. And his PSA was like 3.7. But he knew that that was too high. And so he basically went and self-referred himself to a urologist, had a biopsy, and had Gleason 8 disease.
Wow.
Okay. So he had Gleason 8 disease. He chose to have a radical prostatectomy, had seminal vesicle involvement.
What kind of work did he do?
He works for electrical company, the Baltimore Electrical Company, white, Northern European background. And he looked into clinical trials, came over and saw me, and was enrolled on a clinical trial where he had 2 years of hormonal therapy, he had radiation, and he had chemotherapy as a radiosensitizer. So he got weekly Taxol during it. This was a phase two trial, and they were looking at improving outcome by giving patients, you were taking high-risk patients, and there was like three groups of patients, but one of the groups of patients were patients who you knew you hadn't cured, to see whether adding hormonal therapy and chemotherapy was going to improve outcome. Really looking at the question of chemotherapy as a radiosensitizer, these patients actually started, it's an interesting way that this study was done. Arif Hussein at University of Maryland was actually the PI of the study. And they actually would get their Lupron on a Friday, and then Monday they'd get their first dose of Taxol, and Tuesday they'd start their radiation. And so they actually did not have an antiandrogen. You actually tried to take advantage of a testosterone flare to cycle the cells and then hit them with chemotherapy and continue to hit them with chemotherapy weekly during the radiation and then give them several years of hormonal therapy because he's a high-risk patient. But it was a phase two question looking at response and toxicity.
And how long was the hormonal therapy?
2 years.
What was it? MAB?
It was just Lupron.
So how did this man do?
Oh, he did great. He is well. I just saw him last week. He has an undetectable PSA. And some of the things about him that I think are really interesting, at least to me, I mean, as an oncologist, is that he actually was very, very religious, is that the word, about maintaining his penile health. He took Viagra, he did
sort of Cabergette,
you know, right. And he said, because he didn't have any libido or anything. And this is a person who had 2 years of hormonal therapy, radiation, chemotherapy. Not only does he have an undetectable PSA now out 4 years, but he has normal sexual function. Now he's a young guy, but still, what he went through is amazing.
Does that make sense physiologically?
Well, physiologically, I mean, if you talk to people that specialize in erectile dysfunction, for one thing, hormonal therapy causes penile shrinkage. So what they do is, one of the things it does with the Cabergette, they're forcing the patients to maintain penile length. And also, they actually sort of have this low, you know, the using this idea of vascular fill, however Viagra works, to maintain penile health. And there's some specialists in erectile dysfunction, and that's who he saw, who actually sort of gave him a program of things to do so that at the end of his 2 years of hormonal therapy and radiation and surgery, he would still have potentially normal sexual function, which he does. He actually didn't tell me about it until, like, sort of subsequently, and he then sort of, I think he'd been a little bit embarrassed, and I think they take Viagra daily.
Have there been any, you know, phase three studies to establish whether or not this really works?
There are some studies you mentioned, like Taxotere. There's another ongoing phase two study looking at Taxotere as a radiosensitizer in combination with radiation and hormonal therapy. And I believe there is a current phase 3 planned. Right now, the role of chemotherapy in high-risk disease is sort of in evolution. There's an ongoing phase 3 study that's being done in the CALGB where the patients are randomized to Taxotere, docetaxel, versus no docetaxel, neoadjuvantly, and then they go on to prostatectomy. That's an enrolling study. There's been several trials completed where I was at the University of Maryland where we looked at patients. In fact, there's an ongoing study right now where they get, again, 2 years of hormonal therapy, radiation, and then after they complete their radiation, they get adjuvant docetaxel. The first trial was done with a sort of a weekly regimen that isn't being used anymore now. It was before the intergroup trial showed that every 3 week docetaxel, at least in hormone refractory, is better than the weekly regimen. And so now the docetaxel being looked at as a sort of a standard every 3 week adjuvant chemotherapy for 6 cycles. And the first study that was done, I mean, the patients were patients with Gleason 8, 9, 10 patients, high risk players that you would expect would have a very high relapse rate. And out at 5 years, the relapse rate, and this isn't published, and so there's no final analysis that's been peer reviewed, but you know, the 5-year relapse free survival is over 80%, which is sort of surprising in this real high risk group. So, but where those studies are going, we don't really have an ongoing phase 3 trial. There's some being designed and discussed. CLGB is talking about doing a phase 3 trial, which would be hormonal therapy, radiation versus hormonal therapy, radiation, docetaxel.
So we've had adjuvant chemotherapy in breast cancer since like 1975 right. or 80. We've had it in colon since like around 90. And now we have it in lung, which was real difficult to pull off because of how few patients are eligible, et cetera, now for several years. Why don't we have data at this point in prostate cancer?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, I think the breast cancer surgeons have always seemed to have had a better relationship with medical oncology. It's changed in urology, but I mean, for years, urologists never wanted to refer patients to oncologists, and there's always been sort of a block to referring their patients for chemotherapy. So one trial was done. There was an intergroup trial, the adjuvant mitoxantrone prednisone, and so it was patients who had undergone prostatectomy, high risk for recurrence, received 2 years of hormonal therapy with or without mitoxantrone and prednisone for 6 cycles. And that study initially was accruing terribly. There was very, very, very poor accrual, and it looked like it was never going to be completed, and they almost shut it down. But then the accrual picked up. They really started getting some good alliances between the urologist and the oncologist, and accrual was doing well. And then the study was closed by the monitoring committee because of excess leukemia in the mitoxantrone arm.
Which wasn't a complete surprise. I mean, we know anthracyclines will do that in a small fraction of patients.
I think it was 4 patients that
right.
had leukemia. And so that trial, you know, certainly there's going to be results of that study, although it was never completed, so it's going to end up being underpowered. But I'm assuming that study will be followed and there will be some results. I mean, that study was intended to have 15 years of follow-up. And then there's the attempt to do an adjuvant Taxotere study. Again, that was a global study with, again, patients who had undergone prostatectomy, similar sort of patients, and they were supposed to have be randomized to it was immediate versus delayed hormonal therapy with or without docetaxel. And that study accrued a couple of 100 patients and was closed because they felt that the rate it was accruing at was so slow it would never be completed. So that study was closed within the last year.
What fraction of patients diagnosed with prostate cancer are high risk who might be eligible for a study like that? I've heard varying estimates.
I mean, I would think relatively low number. I mean, I'm thinking maybe a 10% number. The reason I'm thinking low is because, you know, most patients who have a Gleason 8, 9, 10 usually are not directed towards surgery. So
right.
your high-risk patients often don't get surgery.
What about adjuvant chemo after radiation therapy?
Well, see, that's the studies that I've personally been involved with. I've treated a lot of patients on a phase 2 study, a lot being, you know, maybe 30 or 40 patients with radiation, hormonal therapy, and then the adjuvant docetaxel. And those results are looking, in my opinion, better than I would have expected for patients with high-risk disease. And that's the study I hope will really turn into a phase 3 trial.
And breast cancer right now, certainly docetaxel is a very common adjuvant therapy. And actually, one of the reasons is because, you know, leukemias and heart failure are occasionally seen with the anthracycline. So there's been a real shift towards that right now. And the docetaxel cyclophosphamide regimen is a very rapidly increasing regimen in breast cancer. It's considered reasonably tolerable. Actually, it's considered less emetogenic by a lot of people who use it than, say, the anthracyclines. What do you see in men who get adjuvant docetaxel-based regimens?
I think they tolerate it extremely well. If you take a relatively healthy man who's obviously different than a patient with hormone refractory disease, but you know, these are healthy men, they really have very little toxicity. I mean, like in the clinical trial that we were involved with, I don't recall a single patient, for example, being hospitalized.
Well, that was another issue that has come out in breast cancer, particularly in the older patient who's getting this so-called TC regimen, which is preemptive myeloid growth factors to prevent febrile neutropenia, which has been seen, and particularly in some of the older patients. How do you approach that situation with prostate cancer?
Well, looking at the, for example, docetaxel has a grade 3-4 neutropenia is seen in over 50% of the patients. So by the guidelines we use, those patients all qualify to get growth factors. So in general, unless there's, you know, a patient who's maybe, for some reason I don't want to, but in general, these patients, I give them all Neulasta too. And usually they don't have any significant problem.
Are most people who are working able to continue working?
The patients who are on it adjuvantly, yes. Even the patients, you know, your average man with hormone-sensitive metastatic prostate cancer is usually relatively healthy, and there is an ongoing clinical trial that I'm participating in of hormonal therapy. It's an ECOG trial. It's hormonal therapy with or without docetaxel, randomized phase 3 trial for hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. And I have a fellow who's a magistrate who's on the study. And sometimes I feel like we have to adjust his chemotherapy because he's so busy. You know, he says, well, I have something I have to do that week. Can we make my chemotherapy next week? I mean, so I find that earlier stage, even hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, those patients adding the chemotherapy usually doesn't seem to prevent them from going on with their normal activities.
Now, understanding there are limitations to comparing breast and prostate cancer, obviously, but there are a lot of similarities. And one is this issue of hormone therapy and chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting, at least in prostate cancer experimentally. One of the things that was seen in breast cancer is the patients seem to have better outcome if the hormone therapy was delayed until after the chemo. I know the thinking was maybe it was stopping the cycling. It was actually proven in a randomized trial to have fewer recurrences if you waited. Have there been discussions in prostate cancer about that?
Well, I'll use an example of another clinical trial I've been involved with. There is some experimental data, animal data, showing the sequencing in a prostate cancer model. If you give docetaxel before hormonal therapy versus docetaxel with hormonal therapy or hormonal therapy followed by docetaxel, that the best survival, best response is seen in the group that gets the chemotherapy before they get the hormonal therapy.
Same as breast cancer.
Right.
Is this in patients?
No, that is in an animal model, a prostate cancer animal model. So a recent clinical trial that I've been involved with, which is for patients who have a rapidly rising PSA, so very fast doubling time, so they're considered, you know, poor prognosis, even though they're PSA-only recurrence, they're considered to have a relatively rapid disease course because of the fast doubling times. And these patients are being treated, and this is a phase 2 trial, but they're getting 6 cycles of docetaxel followed by hormonal therapy. So the study has been designed to give the chemotherapy first and then give the hormonal therapy for exactly the reasons you said, is that there is some preclinical data, not any clinical data, but preclinical data suggesting that the sequence really is important.
One of the things that bothered people initially in breast cancer about doing that is you were delaying what a lot of people consider the most effective form of therapy of breast cancer, particularly in highly ER-positive tumors, which is hormonal therapy. Same situation here. Now you're holding off on starting it, and a man who's in a high-risk situation. Any sort of global feeling about the benefits of chemotherapy, specifically docetaxel-based chemotherapy, just sort of globally looking at how it, you know, useful or not useful it is in metastatic disease, comparing breast and prostate cancer? I mean, in breast cancer, you know, docetaxel-based chemotherapy obviously is not curative in metastatic right. disease. In the adjuvant setting, it improves the cure rate, but not right. like 100%. You know, it drops it down some. How do you compare the two?
I really don't know that I can actually, obviously, head-to-head compare them. I can tell you that in the hormone refractory setting, it has improved survival by a few months using docetaxel.
What about quality of life in the metastatic setting?
I've seen pretty much the whole spectrum. By that I mean, I remember one particular patient, an elderly fellow who was very sick. He had liver metastases, hormone refractory, had some ascites, and he hadn't been able to do any of the things he really liked. And I put him on docetaxel chemotherapy. He was on a clinical trial. And within a couple of months, I mean, he was going out dancing with his wife. He was going out to dinner. So I've seen that.
How long did the response last?
It only lasted about 6 months.
That's kind of what you see in breast cancer.
I mean, it was relatively short, but, you know, he was so excited about the fact that he felt well enough to go out.
So he was ill? He felt bad when he started treatment?
He felt
bad. What symptoms was he having?
Fatigue, nausea, you know, general malaise.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at, am I ever going to feel good again?
Right.
I understand that I'm going to die of this disease, but am I going to ever feel good first?
Yeah, well, I have a window of time
right.
in which I'll feel better.
And that meant a lot to him.
It meant a lot to him. In fact, I have another gentleman that just finished his third cycle of docetaxel, another man with hormone refractory disease, and he had peritoneal disease, which isn't that common, but again,
wow.
he had ascites and mesenteric caking.
But positive cytology?
Positive, yes, and elevated PSA obviously was going up, and he was really uncomfortable. He had very uncomfortable ascites. His ascites is resolved after three cycles. His follow-up CAT scan, he just got a follow-up CAT scan, his mesenteric caking is going away. I mean, he's got significant tumor reduction. He's up. He's feeling good. His energy level has come back.
Haven't you had a lot of ascites?
Not enough that I had to tap it, but enough that he couldn't wear his clothes and his normal belt wouldn't fit him. And he was really uncomfortable. He was having nausea and he was really uncomfortable. That's about the best thing I could say about it. He was having a lot of discomfort associated. And he was also having a lot of anxiety associated with it because there was something visible that he could see that represented his cancer getting worse. And emotionally, you could see that when his abdomen went down and his energy level went up and his nausea went away, he felt just
hope.
Relieved. Hope. He had hope. So he had this period of time in which he knows he doesn't know how long this will last, but he's feeling good. And now he's planning his summer vacation.
What about other side effect issues with chemotherapy, which, of course, are much more important in the metastatic setting? We talked about myelosuppression. What about other issues, nails, skin, and other kind of weird stuff with docetaxel?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've heard about it is it makes – one patient told me this, and other patients say that's true. It made food taste like cardboard. And I actually had a patient, you know, again, a patient I saw last week who was saying – isn't this sort of counterproductive? This medication is ruining my appetite. I don't feel like eating. I mean, isn't that counterproductive to what we're trying to do? I have cancer, and you want me to eat and maintain my health, and yet this medication has completely affected my taste buds so that nothing tastes good to me right now. And for him, even though his cancer actually is responding to treatment, his taste is bad. And I've heard, and I've recommended this to a few patients, they tell you like to suck on some ice, chips, like decrease flow of blood. Like we used to put ice packs on people's heads
right.
to try to prevent hair
yeah.
loss. Same thing. They tell
you. So it's a sort of anti-cell effect in the taste buds?
Right. And they recommend sucking on ice
so
to before, after,
chemo.
Yeah, you know, and
wow.
during the chemotherapy injection.
Is that seen with other chemo agents? I can't say I've.
It's got a unique effect on taste.
Interesting.
The other
docetaxel.
Thing, docetaxel.
Wow, I never heard that one.
And the other thing, the nails. I had one gentleman whose nails became black.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, the nail changes are just sort of look a little odd. Sometimes they can really be bothersome to the patient. And there was actually a study done where they had people put, again, the same sort of idea. They put a hand in like an ice mitt during infusion.
Right.
And then the other hand they kept up. And they could see that the nail changes were less in using this ice mitt. But again, that's, you know, a problem. I would say when I talk to patients about docetaxel, I usually say we have the neutropenia and you have an increased risk of infection, although it's very rare for me to have a patient come in for that and be hospitalized for that complication. But the taste, you know, that really bothers people. And sometimes the nail changes will really bother people. And the tearing.
Yeah, the tearing and even people sometimes occasionally having to get stinted. What's going on there? How often do you see that?
I've only had a couple of patients have to have stents, but I have seen it. They get basically a stenosis of the tear ducts. And on the surface, I thought this sounded like something terribly uncomfortable to have done, but it doesn't seem to be a terribly bothersome procedure to have done. But
I'm sure patients ask you when they hear the word chemotherapy about nausea, vomiting, and hair loss. How do you respond?
Well, I think as far as the hair loss, most men actually don't lose all of their hair on Taxotere, so they usually have enough hair to cover their head, but there is some loss. With our nausea medicines right now, like the Lacitron, something like that, a pre-medication, usually the patients don't have much of a problem with nausea. Usually if they start to have increasing problems with nausea, I'm usually concerned that their disease is progressing. I think the antiemetics we have are extremely effective, and it's rare for me to have someone say they've vomited. I don't ever hear that anymore.
What about new agents in prostate cancer, and particularly biologic agents? We're seeing that all over cancer medicine right now. One in particular, you're seeing a tremendous amount of research on, is the anti-VEGF agent bevacizumab. It's used now in breast, lung, colon as part of routine care, metastatic disease, trials and adjuvant therapy, ovary, renal, malignant glioma. What about Bev and prostate cancer?
Well, the CALGB just completed their phase 3 trial of docetaxel, bevacizumab versus docetaxel in the hormone refractory setting. That was based on a phase 2 study. Actually, the phase 2 study was a docetaxel estramustine bevacizumab, because that was the docetaxel estramustine was the combination that CLGB was building on. But when they looked at all of the phase 2 studies we did, and we did a series of them looking at different additional agents, that appeared to be the most active combination. And so that led to the phase 3 trial. I would expect the results from that study would be available probably in another year, but not sooner.
Particularly for the urologists who might not have been exposed to this, can you talk a little bit about how bevacizumab works and what's been seen in terms of side effects and toxicity, particularly in patients with prostate cancer?
Well, it's a anti-VEGF antibody, and it basically affects all types of VEGF. And it's given intravenously.
And VEGF being a mediator for angiogenesis.
Yeah, mediator for angiogenesis. And it is given intravenously. It's given over a very short IV infusion. And usually you try to have it lined up with how often we were giving the docetaxel, which is every 3 weeks. So the patients would come in and they'd either just get their docetaxel or they get their docetaxel and the bevacizumab. It's placebo-controlled. And the side effects are really, I mean, the most common side effect is none.
Right. I mean, it's an antibody.
Right.
Like trastuzumab, Herceptin.
Right. So most people have no side effects at all. Hypertension, all the anti-VEGF and VEGF receptor drugs are associated with hypertension. So a number one side effect, some hypertension, which should be easy to control. I haven't had a problem with it in the patients I treated on the study.
And that's definitely what's been seen with the other tumors.
Right.
And I guess most people actually don't get the hypertension, but those that do, it has been stated and, I guess, documented that it's pretty easy to control.
Right, right. So from an internist standpoint, it's not a difficult problem to take care of. They get proteinuria. And the proteinuria, though, doesn't seem to, although you notice it, it's not anything you actually do anything about. You know, we don't really dose adjust based on the proteinuria. I mean, it's sort of an observation of something that it causes, but I don't know that it's really a problem. Then, of course, you have the more serious things that have been associated with Avastin, like bowel perforations and these arterial thrombotic events, which I haven't personally had any problems with myself. But I mean, obviously, it's like when the study was going on, that information came out and there was broad dissemination that, you know, you don't want to have a patient go on the study who's had a recent stroke or heart attack or a problem like that, because there is that potential complication.
The bowel perforation, though, I think I've seen it mainly discussed in terms of colon and ovary,
right,
you know, where things are going on in the belly. I don't know whether you – has it been seen in prostate cancer?
I'm not aware that there has been any bowel perforations.
I guess – because, I mean, it is worth thinking about. I mean, right now, Avastin is part of life for cancer patients, you know, and a lot of tumors. And the surgeons have to know about it because of the potential for wound healing problems.
Right.
I guess that's – I don't know in prostate cancer how often that – might be an issue, but I guess it is important.
Right. I mean, you would want to hold the drug if you were going to be having any sort of surgery, or also if the patient had a thrombotic episode, you either hold the drug or even discontinue the drug permanently.
You know, clearly, again, in almost every tumor right now, there's a lot of discussion about biologics. And I have to ask you about a paper that I saw your name on from the GU Cancer Symposium this year. Because I'm always curious about, like, how these things work, you know? Like,
right.
you talked about Bev. That's sort of straightforward, although people still have no clue why it works. But I saw this thing that you were part of, which was an endothelin A receptor antagonist,
right.
ZD4054.
Well, the endothelians, or endothelin 1, are involved in progression of cancer. They're especially important in the bone microenvironment. And, of course, prostate cancer progresses in bone. Endothelin 1, 2, 3, it's an endothelin family. And endothelians are involved with angiogenesis.
Oh, so these are proteins.
Right,
these are proteins. They're involved with angiogenesis. Okay.
And they're involved in apoptosis. They have a lot of roles, actually. They're involved in pain. And the endothelians bind. There's two receptors. They're endothelin A and endothelin B receptor. Okay. And so ZD 4054 is an endothelin A receptor antagonist. So it basically prevents the binding of endothelin 1.
Like a competitive type
right.
thing?
Right. It's almost like we think of when we think of antiandrogens.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. So it's an antagonist against the endothelin A receptor. Now, there's another drug you've heard of in prostate cancer, atrasentan.
Right.
Okay. Atrasentan is also an endothelin receptor antagonist, but it's not quite as specific as ZD4054. ZD4054 is selective just for the endothelin A receptor. And the importance of that is the A and B receptor sort of do opposite things. So if you just selectively block the endothelin A receptor, it theoretically should be better because you don't have any of the counter effects of slightly blocking the endothelin B receptor, which atrasentan does. So one of the reasons that this study may have been positive, where the atrasentan trials have been sort of more borderline positive, is that it's highly selective for the endothelin A receptor. It's a pill, and all of the endothelin receptor antagonists, atrasentan, ZD4054, have this set of side effects that are like a runny nose, some peripheral edema, and those are the main side effects, is some peripheral edema. And recently, the recent studies, there's been, they're not really sure why, but they've seen some increase in congestive heart failure associated with these, both in the atrasentan trial and in this trial. It's not mentioned in the abstract there. There's a manuscript in preparation, and it is mentioned, you know, in there, but they don't really know. So what was interesting about it, so it's an oral drug, and the study that was done was three arms. It was two different doses of ZD4054, and then the third arm was a placebo. It had a lot of things about it that were slightly different than a lot of the other studies we do in hormone refractory patients, one of which was you did not go off study for PSA progression. So that was not... So patients who went off study had more clinical progression as opposed to going off study for biochemical progression. So the patients were allowed to stay. And some of the criticisms of the atrasentan trial, maybe why it was not a positive study, is that especially in the United States, many patients came off drug outside the guidelines of the study based on PSAs rising, so that the
patient did not want to stay on the study if their PSA was going up. And in this study, maybe because it was done globally, I'm not sure, but it was mostly outside the U.S. that most of the patients were accrued, they had very good compliance, and patients did stay on their designated arm until they met the criteria for going off study. And at the end of the day, there was a significant improvement in overall survival in the patients who received the ZD4054. And that improvement was in the order of 7 months.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive, actually, yeah. Compared to what we've seen with other agents.
Going back to your breast cancer analogy, there is a abstract being presented at the plenary session looking at a bisphosphonate in patients being treated with hormonal therapy. And the patients who were on the bisphosphonate have this, well, it's going to be presented, I think, tomorrow, but they just came out with the abstract. There's an improvement in disease-free survival. And the reason I bring that study up is bisphosphonates have their effect in the microenvironment. And in the study, the thought is that they are preventing cancer from progressing using a drug that has an effect in this microenvironment, where they talk about this vicious cycle where cancer cells arriving at the bone, you know, there's a breakdown of bone, and then they release factors which actually stimulate the growth of those cancer cells. And so drugs that interfere with that vicious cycle, and so the bisphosphonates interfere with that vicious cycle, and so do the endothelin receptor antagonists, and they interfere in different places in the vicious cycle. And so it's possible that even though you weren't seeing a difference in progression-free survival, the overall survival may actually reflect something different that's happening, that you may actually be creating a scenario where the disability associated with their cancer is slower. Or, I mean, I'm not quite sure exactly what is going on, but in my mind, you know, in my analysis of it, I was thinking, well, if you in some way could, these are patients who had bone metastases, didn't have pain, if you in some way could slow down what was going on, not make it go away, but sort of just like slow down the cycle in some way, that you might be able to maintain their quality of their performance status and have it associated with having a longer life. Because, you know, in diseases like hormone refractory prostate cancer, performance status has always been linked to a poorer survival. And so in my mind, maybe if we were maintaining a better, you know, they didn't have pain for a longer period of time. And so you maintained their performance status, their quality of life, and maybe there is a link with living longer. As I said, I don't know exactly what's going on there, but
I mean, that's been seen in breast cancer a couple times.
Right.
Not just this new study. It's been seen in the past, so it's not like totally out of the blue that this could happen. What's the next step with this drug?
Oh, there are two phase three trials, possibly a third phase three trial going on globally, because this was a randomized phase two with survival as the endpoint.
I want to get back to your young man that we started out with, who was on the hormone therapy for 2 years, and get your take on some of the secondary issues of hormonal therapy and prostate cancer that have been coming out now in the last few years. Now, I don't know whether those issues are more or less in a man in his 40s, but what's your take on bone, heart, diabetes, et cetera?
Well, I mean, I think that these large databases do show, I mean, that problems with, for example, heart disease, you know, that there really is a increased incidence of sudden death and cardiac problems in patients who receive hormonal therapy. Also, we've talked about the diabetes, which at least from some information that suggests that maybe it's more of an obesity issue rather than a diabetes issue. I've been more concerned about the side effects of hormonal therapy as we all sort of have an increased awareness of it. I'm getting more of my patients into the whole concept of it's heart healthy, it's prostate cancer healthy, lose weight, exercise programs. I mean, they've shown that patients on hormonal therapy who have an exercise program feel better.
What happened with this man? Did he exercise?
Oh, yeah. This is a person. This is a guy who's out running. Yeah, you know, he didn't let it slow him down much at all.
Yeah.
But there is a big concern. And one of the things that's happened, at least for me, as I start thinking about the negative sides of hormonal therapy, increased risk of fractures, and a couple of years ago, I would say 5 years ago, patients who would come to me with a rising PSA after prostatectomy, so a PSA-only recurrence, And the patient was, you know, very concerned about it. And we would have this discussion about how we don't have any randomized trials that tell us that early versus delayed hormonal therapy is better or worse. But many of the patients would say, you know, I'm very concerned. My PSA is going up. Aren't you going to do something about it? I said, well, we can start you on some hormonal therapy. It'll probably bring your PSA down, which it does, and probably stay down for years, and which it usually does. And many of those patients, I would put on hormonal therapy. Now, I have a different conversation with the patients. Now I start talking to them about, I start looking at PSA doubling times. You know, I'll say, well, your PSA is going up, but the rate at which it's going up is so slow that the likelihood of you dying of your prostate cancer is less than the likelihood of you dying of something else. And if I give you hormonal therapy, I may increase your chance of having a heart problem or increase your chance of having diabetes or some other, or break, you know, having a fracture. And so where I used to be much more willing to treat most patients with biochemical recurrence with hormonal therapy, now I'm much more selective, and I take a lot more time counseling these patients about the pros and cons of hormonal therapy. And so, you know, certainly a patient with a rapidly rising PSA, not only would I put them on hormonal therapy, I'd probably try to enroll them in a clinical trial.
Would you consider giving chemotherapy off study to a patient who's hormone sensitive, you're about to start hormones or PSA recurrence, but rapid doubling time?
I would not want to do that. I have patients who will come to me, you know, sort of educated patients who've been reading a lot of literature, and they'll say, well, why not just give me the chemotherapy now? And I tell them, because we don't have the data to say that that's the right thing to do. And that even though I've talked about how chemotherapy is usually well tolerated, you know, it does cause things like neutropenia, and, you know, you could actually have a fatal complication of chemotherapy. You could.
What about hormone insensitive PSA only disease, rapid doubling time? Chemo off study there?
That patient, I still have not given that patient chemotherapy off study.
Sounds like you're struggling a little.
I'm struggling because there are patients, you know, who don't fit nicely into a clinical trial that you really feel you want to give chemotherapy. And I would say there's at least two patients that I have given chemotherapy for earlier stage disease off study. And they were both actually relatively similar patients. One patient was a gentleman who was to have a prostatectomy. And when they got in there, they found he had nodal disease. And he had no other metastatic disease. And so he had active disease, and we had a long discussion. I told him that I don't have data on this, but we elected to go ahead and give him both chemotherapy and hormonal therapy. And since I was doing it outside of a clinical trial, I decided to give it to him based on preclinical data, the way I thought it would have the most likelihood of helping him. So I gave him 6 cycles of docetaxel, and then I started his hormonal therapy, which he's on indefinitely.
So could you see the nodes when imaging?
No.
So no, nothing to follow other than his PSA?
Right. And his PSA did drop with docetaxel before he got hormonal therapy. He had about a 60% drop in his PSA.
Getting back to the hormone issues, what about bone density measurements? In what situations do you do it? I mean, did you get it on this 40-some-year-old man?
Yes, he's had a bone density. His bone density right now is normal. I usually tell patients, if I'm going to be treating you with hormonal therapy for 6 months or less, so let's say a patient with an intermediate risk prostate cancer is going to get radiation in 6 months of hormonal therapy, that the risk for your bone is relatively small and we don't need to do it. But anyone who's going to be going on hormonal therapy for 2 years, or certainly anyone who's going to be going on it for longer, I get a baseline bone density and then I follow up with it usually yearly. There's always an issue of payment in this scenario, but it really hasn't turned out to be an issue. You can write a letter and justify it.
Any complementary or alternative strategies that you bring up to patients with, you mentioned before, PSA-only disease, but slow doubling time, so you don't want to really give them hormone, maybe give them something to do? And I'm particularly interested about the possibility of dietary intervention because of what's been seen in breast and colon cancer, which is preliminary data saying maybe there are fewer recurrences in people who eat less fat, calories, and keep their weight under control, which is amazing. But I don't know that we have that data in prostate. I think it's starting to be looked at.
Right. I have to admit, I usually explain to patients, I usually say, I'm not a specialist in this area. I always give my disclaimer first. And then I said, but if you want to know, based on the data that's out there, what I think, I said, I think soy is good.
Really?
Soy's got phytoestrogen in it. So it's sort of like mini hormonal therapy in my mind. And there have been reports of patients whose PSAs have dropped just taking soy. So I usually tell them I think they should increase the soy in their diet.
By doing what? I mean, how do you?
Oh, soybeans, not soy capsules. But, you know, I said put soy milk on your cereal in the morning, have like soybeans or some sort of soy product. And having looked around in the grocery store, there's lots and lots of soy products. And then I usually tell them that they should try to keep their weight at some sort of ideal weight. So if they're overweight, I tell them I think that they should try to lose a little weight. There has certainly been a link between obesity and survival in prostate cancer. So people that are overweight can have a worse outcome. I usually say what's heart healthy is prostate healthy. So that, you know, a lot of fat, you know, fatty meat, you know, cut the fat off your meat. I don't promote them taking like drugs like selenium and vitamin E, which have been looked at from a prevention standpoint. I usually tell them that just because there may be an association with prevention of prostate cancer, it's not necessarily a treatment for prostate cancer. I don't tell them they have to stop it, but you know, a lot of these patients are taking lycopene and selenium and vitamin E. And
getting back to your patient, I'm thinking about too, his wife having had a bone marrow transplant for CML. How old are their kids?
They're now like 8, 10, and 12. They're a very close family. They're very involved with their children, and they've been open with their children. It's been very, very hard when the wife had her transplant. She went out to Seattle, and you know, they're from the East Coast. They went to the West Coast. Grandparents came in to help take care of the children, and that's a long process. We're talking about months and months being away. And then, you know, he went through his cancer, chemotherapy, radiation, hormonal therapy, and sort of a vigorous program to maintain his personal health. And he has this most wonderful attitude. The family's doing very well. They have a very strong marriage. And as I said, I just saw him a few days ago. And, you know, he always waits to hear what his PSA is. And his PSA was undetectable still. And he was commenting about that his goal is to just keep coming back and seeing me for years and years and years, because as long as I keep telling him his PSA is undetectable, life is good.